This week, despite growing international pressure for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza, Israel vows to continue its military operation.
A ceasefire means one thing and one thing only: ensuring the survival of Hamas.
Families of loved ones still held hostage by Hamas demand action. VOA speaks with the mother of one of those still in captivity.
We need the world here, the power of the world, the power of mothers, you know, mothers like me, that to just put the pressure on and to get these people, these women back. You know, now we don't have any time to spare here.
And Ukraine takes a step closer to EU membership, but with another setback when it comes to urgently needed military aid. Join us on Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Israel says it will keep fighting Hamas despite international calls for a ceasefire and predicts a drawn-out war, even as it faces increasing alarm over the devastation from its campaign in Gaza.
Hamas is a terror organization that built itself for a decade to fight Israel. And they built infrastructure under the ground and on the ground. And it is not easy to destroy them. It will take and require a long period of time. It will last more than several months.
Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant on Thursday, while meeting with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in Tel Aviv, the United States has been urging Israel to scale down its war in Gaza.
In the name of humanity, I ask you all once again, stop this violence now.
The United Nations demanded Tuesday an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. Diane Tu with Reuters has this report.
After dire warnings by UN officials about a growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, more than three-quarters of the 193-member UN General Assembly backed the resolution. The U.S. and Israel voted against the measure, along with eight other countries.
Ceasefire means one thing and one thing only: ensuring the survival of Hamas.
The resolution is not binding, but it carries political weight, reflecting a global view on the war. A similar vote was held in the 15-member UN Security Council last week and vetoed by the United States. The Palestinian Authority welcomed the resolution and urged countries to pressure Israel to adopt the ceasefire, as fighting between Israel and Hamas intensified across Gaza. Residents said Israeli shelling in the south was some of the heaviest in days, despite its forces earlier ordering people to flee there for safety. There are growing signs Israel is becoming diplomatically isolated over its conduct of war. Biden told a campaign donor event earlier on Tuesday that most of the world still backs Israel, but that it was, quote, starting to lose that support by indiscriminate bombing.
Diane Tu with Reuters reporting. More than 18,700 Palestinians have been killed, according to the health ministry in the Hamas-controlled territory. Here's UN General Assembly President Dennis Francis.
What we are witnessing is the unprecedented collapse of an already crumbling humanitarian system in real time.
And for a better understanding of what's happening on the ground in Gaza, I spoke with John Linden, executive director with the Alliance for Middle East Peace.
We could have used the word dire many weeks ago and also been accurate. It's hard to find like new levels of language to describe the situation as it continues to deteriorate. I saw a report yesterday that, you know, families of up to seven people were getting a bottle of water and a can of tuna for their daily sort of allowance. That's after having been in line all day. So we have a confluence of many problems. There's the fact that 1.8 million people are out of their homes and internally displaced. We have still way insufficient amounts of food and medicine entering the Gaza Strip. There's been a slight improvement because Kerem Shalom, the Israeli crossing, is now being used for scanning and processing trucks before they return to Rafah, but it's still too slow. And of course, the weather has really shifted. It's been heavy rains and it's very cold overnight. And many, many people, including people I know, fled their homes with very little with them, you know, sort of changes of clothes or bedding for children. In fact, that colleague of mine mine, his sister-in-law had a little baby boy 4.5-5 weeks ago now, and you can just imagine trying to care for a newborn infant in a situation like that. One of the things that we're particularly worried about now is the sort of mixing of raw sewage because of some of the flooding from the rains with, you know, water that people are drinking. So I think you're hearing more and more reports day by day of the risk of waterborne infection, you know, some reports even of hostages who've been returned and viruses being found and blood samples being taken. And I think we're already in a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, but the danger if we have epidemic levels of disease, it's hard to fathom what we will do. So every day that goes past just makes things much worse for the human beings living in the Gaza Strip. And I think also sort of zooming out a little bit, the levels of trauma for both Palestinians and for Israelis that we're dealing with, it just makes the mountain that we're unavoidably going to have to climb after that ceasefire that bit steeper, right? So the sooner this war can end, I think the better for everybody.
What will be left? What will it take to rebuild the entire region of Gaza to be actually a place people can live?
This is going to be one of the biggest concerns once we move out of this initial sort of triage phase. I mean, there's reports that over half of the housing stock in the northern Gaza Strip has been destroyed or damaged, which is extraordinary. You know, these are places I've spent some time. These are big built up urban environments to have, you know, so much housing destroyed, people internally displaced who cannot leave, right? So they're going to be expected to return to their homes at some point, but their homes aren't there. And even if the resources were there to be able to reconstruct all those homes, and they aren't, there is a lag, right? There's going to be upwards of 1 million people who are homeless in the immediate aftermath of this, and no immediate prospect of where they'll be housed or whether a third country would take them or whether they would go unless they were given some sort of promise of return. And there's environmental degradation as well. Gaza was already a place that had some significant issues with regards to the water table and the sort of the aquifers that are feeding the Gaza Strip. And now there's, I think, danger of the water table being contaminated, which is obviously necessary to sustain a population of 2.3 million people. So these are deep searching questions that I feel that people haven't even begun to scratch the surface of. We also saw earlier this week, Ambassador Lana Nusseibeh, the Emirati ambassador to the United Nations, giving quotes to the Wall Street Journal and saying that the United Arab Emirates will not contribute towards reconstruction efforts unless it's associated with a very clear US-led plan to deliver a Palestinian state. And I think I just came back from the Gulf myself. I've been talking to American and European diplomats pretty constantly. There is no appetite to rebuild the Gaza Strip again, because this is not the first time that we've had a huge reconstruction on our hands, without there being clear assurances that what is being built isn't going to be blown up again. And the only way you can get that assurance is a diplomatic process that can actually end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I think all of those things need to come together in the aftermath of this. There cannot be reconstruction of Gaza without some sort of a diplomatic horizon that can demonstrate that this is the last time that we're building again from the ashes in the Gaza Strip.
Will there be anything left if this continues for months and months? Israel says it's not going to stop until Hamas is gone.
I mean, if the same level of destruction is visited on the southern Gaza Strip that we saw in the north, then Gaza will be leveled. I mean, for all intents and purposes, you will then have over half of the physical infrastructure in the entire strip either destroyed or damaged. And that's just not acceptable for that to be an option on the table. I know that Jake Sullivan was in Israel for high-level discussions with the war cabinet and with others around ways in which the operation could change. And I think there's interesting language being introduced about moving to a more low-intensity phase. And understanding, as you said, if Israel's goal is to disarm or to weaken Hamas's governing ability, but to take away its ability to wage war against Israel, you know, that's a difficult goal to achieve. But I think that there is limited international support for that to be achieved via high-intensity bombing nonstop. In a funny way, if you went back to October 7th and you remember the level of goodwill that there was toward Israel to have to respond to Hamas's attacks, if we had the time again, a more thoughtful and less intensive initial approach, and to be more sort of surgical and rigorous in a way to achieve those goals, may have been a better path to go down, because I think the clock is ticking now. I think both President Biden, Secretary Blinken, and now Jake Sullivan as well have made that clear. And it's a matter of weeks from what we're hearing from the United States. And it remains to be seen whether those goals set out at the start of this campaign are achievable within a few weeks. And one of my worries is if Israel feels that that clock is ticking, they may be incentivized to actually increase the intensity of the operation in order to try and inflict the maximum damage before the stopwatch goes. And I think that would be a grave mistake as well.
John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace. Meanwhile, the families of those still being held by Hamas are demanding more be done to secure their release. And with all the horrific video footage from the October 7th attack on Israel, One of the most jarring shows a young Israeli woman, hands bound behind her back, with blood on the seat of her pants as she's dragged by her hair out of the back of a Jeep by Hamas captors. She is 19-year-old Na'ama Levy. I spoke with her mother, Ayelet Levy Shahar, who has not seen or heard from her daughter since.
I can't personally imagine, I'm sure others have said this, that what you're going through, and particularly seeing that horrific video, the images, how a mother could, much less anyone. I've been haunted by it. I know many have. I appreciate your taking the time. I know this is nuts. You would rather be sitting at home with your daughter than talking to the media.
And it has been a nightmare. But it is important for me to, you know, to speak and to tell the story and to tell about Na'ama and all the other, you know, there are still 17 young women, teens, some of them kept in Gaza, kidnapped and held hostage there. So this nightmare continues. And I want to speak up about that.
I've heard you say that it's important for the world to see that video of your daughter. Why is that?
You know, the details of the video, the brutal images of her being dragged and wounded and handcuffed and with her pajamas and her blood-stained pants. You know, for me, it's the most terrible thing a mother can see, of course. But this has happened. This is what is going on. And it is important for the world to see, because we need the world. We need the world here, the power of the world, the power of mothers, you know, mothers like me, that to just put the pressure on and to get these people, these women back, you know, now.
Yeah.
We don't have any more time to spare here.
We're not really hearing anything in the news much about the hostages, from officials, from the Red Cross, about the people like Na'ama who are still being held. And have you received any information or any updates? Or
No communication and no information officially from any of the, you know, the Red Cross or other organization, humanitarian organizations that, you think that their assignment is to bring information about their well-being from captivity and to forward, you know, medical aid or basic health care needs or medications. We have nothing from that. We did get a sign of life from Na'ama, from the hostages that have returned, the mothers and the children. It's almost 2 weeks, I think, since then. So we do know that she's there and she's alive and she's walking. But we don't have further information and no official contact with her.
Have you tried to contact the Red Cross?
Yes, we have. I, you know, as a physician, I sat in one of the meetings with the Red Cross. They do say that they do not have cooperation from Hamas to enter and to do their assignment. But then they also do not come out with a statement saying this, you know, worldwide, that, you know, they say this in the talk with us. But, you know, I would expect, if they cannot do what they're assigned to do, then I would expect them to sound that off. And you know, again, for the world to hear.
Why is it that we're hearing about bombing and we're hearing about the war, but we're not hearing much about those people that are still being held?
Oh, that is a very good question. That is a very good question. And, you know, I've been asked this and I don't know the answer. I'm just, you know, I'm asking the same questions. Why is it that we don't hear about, you know, there have been crimes against humanity since October 7th, on October 7th and since, because there were 240 hostages and there are still 100, almost 140 kidnapped people, innocent people that are kept there since the terror attack. And we're not hearing that so much. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, because maybe I'm not aware of all the worldwide media that's going on. But I don't see that out there. Definitely not as much as you see about the bombings and attacks in Gaza. So that's a good question. My answer is that it is a good question. Why not?
What can you tell us about the last time you spoke with your daughter?
I spoke to her on Friday night because I was planning to visit her on Saturday, because she was visiting there in Nahal Oz Kibbutz. So she, you know, she told me, and then she texted me what to bring for her, t-shirts and, you know, socks and things like that. And then on the morning of the attack, we heard the sirens go off, and we went to the bomb shelter in the building. And when we came up, you know, me and the kids, I texted her again. I said, "Nana, what's going on?" And she just wrote to me. And that was the last time she wrote. She wrote, "We're in the safe room, and I haven't heard anything like this in my life." So that was, and then when I texted her again, I didn't, that was unread and unreplied.
And she had just started her national service a few weeks before that, before she was taken. What can you tell us about who she is? What should people know about her?
Well, I think everyone's seen her photo, her beautiful smile, and she's just a gentle, soft-spoken girl. Gentle, but yet very determined, and in her quiet way. She finished high school, she majored in diplomacy, and she was always looking for how to, you know, talk about a bridge between communities. And she was a member of Hands of Peace youth organization, which promotes talks of peace and communication between Israelis, Palestinians, and Americans. She was part of a delegation from that, and that's what she is. That's who she is. A year after high school, just until recently, she was in a year of volunteer and community work, where she volunteered in a kindergarten for African refugees, always looking for how to do good in the world. And you know, she does know how to speak up for herself. She has like a very clear voice, I think more than me. You know, that's what she is. And she loves just to hang out with her friends, and then and with her brothers and sister, and just, you know, just my little girl. She's my little girl. She's my daughter. And it's terrible. Yeah, it's just terrible. We just want her back. We just miss her so much.
And you haven't heard of any efforts to try to work on getting the hostages out?
Well, the negotiations have stopped,
yeah,
according to what we understand from our talks with government officials and from the media. And what we do understand that they're attempting to start negotiations again, but we don't know where it stands right now because the attacks or the bombings are going on. So, you know, I don't know any better than you, I guess, on that part.
And of course, we've heard these horror stories of Hamas sexual violence against women coming to light. Given the video you saw, as a mother, as a physician, what is the message the world needs to hear about this?
Well, you know, as difficult as it is for me to speak about it, our concern, what scares us, what scares me is that exact thing, that the sexual assaults that we do know by testimonials that were there on the 7th of October, and from testimonials of hostages returning, and from that video that you can clearly see her bloodstained pants, and we don't know, you know, we don't want to think about the worst, but we can't avoid that. So all the risks that have to do with that, with the sexual assault, and, you know, even pregnancy, and women in this conditions, that they are the most vulnerable to these conditions of being kept hostage, and not only sexual violence, but anything else. You know, they're more vulnerable physically and emotionally. So we know that, you know, by research, not just because I'm a mother, I'm saying this. And, you know, their basic needs, women's basic needs, it's concerning in so many ways. We just need to get them out. You know, that's why I'm speaking. That's why I'm talking here at this. You know, it's so difficult to bring this up and to think and talk about it all the time. But I just want the world's help to sound this voice and to put pressure to help bring them all back. Bring my Nana back.
I'm so sorry that we're speaking again under these circumstances and that you have to keep reliving the situation without any resolution yet.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ayelet Levy Shahar, whose daughter Na'ama is still in Hamas captivity. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London.
This is a historic moment.
Ukraine got a green light Thursday to speed up talks on joining the European Union, bypassing objections from Hungary to give Kyiv a major political boost as its war against Russia's invasion grinds on. But the EU failed to agree on a 50 billion euro package in financial aid that Ukraine desperately needs to stay afloat. The aid, vetoed by Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, was another blow to Ukraine's president after he failed this week to persuade U.S. lawmakers to approve additional aid for Ukraine. Belgium Prime Minister Alexander De Croo offered some reassurance.
The message to Ukraine is we will be there to support you. We need to figure out a few of the details to get there, but we will be there.
This week, Russian President Vladimir Putin gave his end-of-year speech to his nation and said Russia will not give up its fight in Ukraine, Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
A relaxed Putin spoke amid battlefield gains and flagging Western support for the fight in remarks interpreted by National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
There will only be peace, quote, when our goals are achieved, end quote.
Kirby says Putin is doubling down on his aims to conquer a sovereign nation.
I sure hope that those House Republicans who have for months held hostage critical assistance to Ukraine heard Putin's message loud and clear.
Instead, he says the House GOP has left Washington for the holidays and left Ukrainians without American money to help them fight back.
They need it right now, not after the eggnog.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
And for further analysis, I spoke with Doug Klain, non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council and policy analyst at Razum for Ukraine.
I think that Vladimir Putin is feeling emboldened by everything that's been happening in Washington. He's telling us exactly what he thinks and what he's going to do. And when he tells us what he's going to do, we should believe him. Putin has from the beginning bet that he will win in Ukraine because Americans are going to get tired of it. He's betting that we will be too distracted and too divided to stand with Ukraine and give them the tools that they need to beat the Russian forces back. Now, for the first time, I think Congress is starting to signal that maybe he's right. Now, it's been a news-filled couple of weeks, but a very stark signal was sent when, for the first time, the Senate actually blocked aid to Ukraine, and Senate Republicans voted it down. Now, since then, Senate negotiators have been working quite feverishly to come up with some kind of a deal to trade immigration policy changes in exchange for this foreign aid. It looks like we may well get a deal, perhaps before the end of this year. But all that being said, there has been a tremendous amount of damage done to the vision of the U.S. as a trustworthy, reliable ally.
Without more U.S. aid, what would happen? What would it mean for Ukraine and for Europe as a whole, and of course, the United States?
Already, Ukrainian soldiers are reporting that they are running low on ammunition. In the early days of this war, Russia had a 10-to-1 artillery advantage. They could fire 10 artillery shells for every one shell that the Ukrainians could fire back. Thanks to U.S. aid, we helped the Ukrainians close that gap pretty much to a 1-to-1 ratio. Since then, the gap is widening now as our aid has started to decline because Congress has not appropriated new funding. Now, these gaps will continue to widen as Ukrainian magazines quite literally just start running empty. They don't have the ammunition or the tools that they need from us to keep up the fight. Now, the Ukrainian people have made it very clear whether they have the best weapons in the world or not, they are going to keep fighting. But there is going to be a tremendous amount of suffering and death that does not need to happen. That can be avoided if the U.S. gives Ukraine what it needs. If Russia overruns Ukraine, we will be faced with perhaps the greatest security threat and failure of foreign policy for the United States in 50 years, you know, certainly since the fall of Saigon. The stakes could not be higher here.
What could it mean specifically in Europe and for the U.S.?
Well, let's say that, you know, Vladimir Putin's ideal vision of, you know, what he made it very clear he wants to do. Let's say that comes true. Let's say that Russian forces break through the front line in Ukraine. Let's say those forces march in columns back towards Kyiv. They conquer Ukraine. They kill President Zelensky. They put into action these lists of Ukrainian leaders. They start rounding up people into camps. They made it very clear in the early days that they had identified those who could lead a resistance effort against Russian occupation, and they would try to take them out in advance. Ukraine could fall, and then Russian forces keep marching west. They have made it very clear that their ambitions do not stop with Ukraine. It stops with more NATO allies. It stops with the Baltics, Poland, and further west. And if Russia were to expand this war after conquering Ukraine, that's something that would pull in the United States. We are obligated to come to the defense of our NATO allies. So it is a much better deal for the American people to make sure that Ukrainians have the tools they need to stop Russia now, rather than have American soldiers stop Russia tomorrow.
Doug Klain, non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council and policy analyst at Razum for Ukraine. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.